You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Well, yeah. We are here to talk a little bit about the Power Athlete Hypertrophy Standard, or what we call the Hypertrophy Seminar. And where this came about is, as you guys might be aware or not aware or living under a rock, we've been running these Hammer 90 tests. And what we've been doing is kind of taking small segments of Power Athlete, pulling them aside and doing custom programming, nutrition, macros, team meetings, private Discord, and created this really cool boutique experience. And as we got into it, you know, people adhere to the calories, they adhere to the macros, their food, people are getting incredible results. But as we were going back and looking at some of the body, like body scans and DEXA scans and whatnot, certain people put on a lot more muscle than other people. And for the most part, the macros were super consistent across the group. I mean, not identical. Some people got a little bit more, but everybody was within the same kind of macronutrient ratios, following the same training program. And why is it that certain people put on more muscle than others? The only thing, or the only variable we can't account for, is actually the execution of the movements and them chasing relative intensity in the gym, because we don't have eyes on that. So what we wanted to do is create an event to get all these power athlete people here so that we can actually put our hands on them, get into it, understand the mechanisms of hypertrophy, and then have some fun training and try to see if we can get people a little bit farther than they were.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioned like maybe you've been living under the rock. There's been enough time now since we had seminars on the road that I'm sure there's a lot of people don't realize this is kind of the bread and butter of power athlete, right? Was always getting in front of people, watching them move and getting them to move better and execute the movements better. And so it's going to be kind of exciting to get back to that, because programming is great. And yeah, everybody, you know, you get in the Discord on whatever program we have and everybody's like, oh, this program is so great. And that's cool. But you and I both know it's like, that's not really the secret to a successful program. Isn't the X's and O's. It's how you play that game. So it'll be cool to help people along with that and let them take it back to their garage or wherever they're going and get more gains than what they've been getting.
Yeah. No, the Hammer 90 has been really interesting. I mean, to the point where I know, you know, Hunter's like, we got to start collecting data and actually use this stuff for sort of a little bit of research, because the information is so glaring. You know, like we can sell templates, we can give people macros, but creating the community, pulling them into a private program, their own unique Discord, putting all these touch points in place, I think is the secret sauce for helping people mm-hmm. reach their goals. And now we need to kind of balance it on the other side and put our hands on people. I mean, not only do I want to film the content, do I want to meet people, but it's fun to train. And like you mm-hmm. said, I mean, that's how we cut our teeth. I mean, I taught, you know, we taught 300 plus seminars on every continent on the planet. And I think I taught something like just under 200 of them. I taught like 180 of those seminars. Yeah. So, I mean, that first year we taught 36, which was crazy. I was sick for like a month. But going on the road and actually showing up in, you know, Bodø, Norway in the Arctic Circle, you know, flying in and teaching a two-day seminar to a bunch of people you'd never meet. I mean, that's how we really cut our teeth. That's how we fast-tracked Power Athlete. And I don't think there's another way. Like if I had to, you know, ask me to build Power Athlete the way we built it then, today, it doesn't exist. But I'd love to get back to being able to do some in-person seminars, just because it was such a rich experience. And when we look at the majority of people that are still sticky and still follow Power Athlete, a lot of them came to those original seminars. So love to reboot it. I'm just worried people are like, can you put this online? I'm like, no, get the fuck out of your mom's basement.
Let's fucking go. Yeah, there is a little bit of that, right? Some people want it delivered directly to them. And but that's the thing. It's you and I talk all the time about there's value in exclusivity, and part of the exclusivity is just showing up, right? There's not a huge barrier to entry, and we can probably get talking about that later, but it's like, you know, there needs to be, what do they say? Fortune favors the bold, right? The person who actually goes should get something more than the every person, right? There should be some incentive for that. And so, yeah, I think this seminar is going to be great. you know, and again, like you said, a lot of people, the people who stuck around started with the seminar. I started first by going to the seminar. All of our coaches, I would say, I'm guessing probably started with one or multiple times going to the seminar and then came down. And so it is that person-to-person interaction, I think, where the real connections are made.
Yeah. So let's get into a little bit of like what people are going to see at this seminar. Obviously, we're going to come in, we're going to do, I'm going to do a baseline talk on hypertrophy, what it is, you know, how it, like in the mechanisms of hypertrophy. I think in the, let me think, in the, because I've been going back on the academy, you know, that original academy when we sat down, we were still using a bunch of Zaskorsky and Verkhoshansky stuff, which talked about, you know, five different drivers for hypertrophy. And what's been amazing is in the years since then, it's really just boiled down to about two. And one is mechanical tension. So you have to create tension and you have to be working towards failure. Now, and there's a direct relationship between how close to failure you are and percentage of 1RM. The heavier the weight, the bigger the margin of error. The lighter the weight, the smaller the margin of error. But those two are like the major drivers. I mean, even to the point where they did some pretty cool research on blood flow restriction because they always thought that it was the metabolites. All it's doing is fatiguing fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers at a greater rate so you can get to failure and create that mechanical tension. And then more importantly, how do you see it in real time? And that's one of the things which really comes down to is understanding how close people are and like, what does the bar speed look like? What does the path look like? And really it's not, you know, it's loosening the lug nuts just enough to get a little bit of rattle, but not so much that the tires come off. And then movement selection is another one. And we talked a little bit about that earlier. You know, the old bodybuilder guys I used to train with used to constantly talk about, you know, movement selection. Oh, this movement's great. This movement, I don't like this movement. And I always remember watching them and it was just slight variations. Like, I think, Tom Newman, who we had on the podcast talked about from all their research, 3 degrees of change is a different muscle group. So like, you know, how you move your hand, if you move it out, different positions. So finding the advantageous position for each movement and then actually using the movement. I mean, just saying like, I used it once and I didn't feel anything. It doesn't really do it for me. You have to move it and use it with enough frequency and play with enough to find if that movement is a driver for you. I mean, I know we were talking like, I have a iso hammer incline in the gym that I love. And it's always been a one-to-one for me. Like heavy weighted dips, iso incline, seated dumbbell press, and close grips were like, you know, the staple for all of my upper body stuff. And Paul Carter was like, I hate that machine. I never feel it. I'm like, really? I think that one's great for me. And when I watched him do it, the way he was doing it was different than mine. And I had him on my try this. And he's like, I don't like to do that. I, you know, here's better machines for me. And I think for a guy who's advanced, who's been training a long time, that's good for him. But helping people find the exact position and are they really training the movements that they're training and hitting the muscles that they want to hit.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you want to build thick sidewalk splitting slabs of muscle? Let me introduce you to Jack Street. Get access to the same tried and true training methods I followed during my 10 years in the NFL, all to walk into training camp at 308 pounds at sub 8% body fat. Punch your ticket to the gain train and join thousands of residents already following Jack Street. Head to powerathletehq.com/Jack Street and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show.
Yeah. You know, and real quick going back, you know, we talked about the two drivers, I think that's going to be a big benefit for the people jumping in on the seminar is the idea of failure. You know, you and I have both trained in environments where we've really gone to failure and we've had people there to make sure we go to failure, right? I think a lot of individuals, because I do this myself in the garage when you're by yourself, especially on like squats or things like that, when it's like, hey, work up to, you know, a heavy triple. It's kind of scary when you get that heavy, right? And if you don't have, you know, even if you got spotter arms and stuff, it's like, I don't want to die right now. But if you get around a few people who are kind of doing the same thing with the same mindset, it's like, man, I can really push and I can really find what failure, or at least near failure, feels. And this is, you and I have talked a lot about like the reps in reserve. Yeah. The problem with that is people don't know that whatever the end point is, right? And so I'm really excited to get folks down. Because I was looking at the list of folks who signed up so far before we jumped in, and it's like, yeah, these are people who have been around for a while, and get them in and really expose them to, you know, that level of stimulus, because then you can take that back. And it's like, once you get to that point, once you really feel like what true failure feels like, then you just recalibrate all of your percentages and all of your effort sets and rep sets and stuff. And so I'm excited for that because, again, when you're training by yourself in the garage, you don't really want to push yourself, especially if you're a morning guy and you're like, man, I got to go to work now and I can't move my legs and all that kind of stuff. So
that's kind of why I throw, always throw like a heavy mover, like, you know, like let's say it's like a heavy compound movement and you put, you know, you have them work up to something and they don't have to be, you know, like let's say it's a 5, a 7, or an 8 or something, or a 6, or, you know, whatever the rep range we push. So trying to work up to a rep max. And I know on that first one, they're going to have a ton of effort. And I also think too, people train at like 5 in the morning. So I got to be smart about this. I got to give them a good ramp up. I mean, the last thing I want them to do is die on the sword under a heavy barbell at 5 a.m. So we can kind of push that a little bit. But then what I'll do is I'll use little things like pre-fatiguing, like, hey, I'm going to hit a bunch of hamstring, a bunch of glute, kind of get them into a bigger position or a better position so we don't have to go as heavy to keep driving. And then once they get there, just get them into something like a unilateral, like let's use a Bulgarian, for example, or some form of, you know, lunge or step up or, you know, something else that we can work to failure, where once they hit failure, they actually drop a dumbbell or a kettlebell and the bar is not basically stapling them to the bottom of the ground. So, yeah. I mean, there's some pretty interesting ways to kind of skin this thing where you can get a lot of your main driver work and then kind of finish with a little bit of this, like, you know, I mean, do you have to go to failure in your squat? No, if it's heavy enough, margin of error is pretty big. But then when we get into these smaller accessories, that's where we can really kind of push and smash people. And I think that's where the program's always been really good. You know, like, you know, hit your most neurologically demanding, most physically demanding movements first, and then clean it all up with some of the accessory movements where you're not going to kill yourself. Because at the end of the day, I mean, very few people have access to a bunch of selectorized equipment. I mean, I always think, dude, if you design for the gym, you can go into a commercial gym and have no problems. The problem is if you are designed for a commercial gym, people in the garage have no fucking idea what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been the nice thing going to this, this Iron Pit is they got all the machines I could want. So now it's like, oh, this is, you know, we had plenty of equipment in the garage, but it is your standard, I'll say like barbell based type equipment, which does limit you on some of this creativity. And, yeah, you get all those machines and you can do pretty much anything you'd ever want. And so, you know, yesterday there was, we had lat pull down bicep curls, right? Mm-hmm. Seated lat pull down bicep curls. And even the number of handles they had, right? So between sets, I went from a standard bar, then they had like the easy pull down bar, and then they had a fat bar. And it was just like little things like that, kind of getting back to your movement selection thing. It's like, yeah, they all felt a little different, right? A little bit of a tweak here, a little bit of tweak there. And so it was a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun doing that. And it just makes me think like I'm going to have to sink like $40,000 into my new version of the garage to get everything I want now.
I'm all for it. you know, one of the interesting things that I found, especially with all these different, like you were saying, like you're hitting all these different, you know, lat pull downs, you got, you know, fat bar in this. One thing that was a big driver for me, especially for my back and for my arms, was actually squeezing the dumbbell or the barbell as hard as I could. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people just kind of cup it. And that's why, you know, they use a strap. What I do is I actually create as much tension as I can and I squeeze the handle like I'm trying to smash it. And I think that internal tension really helps, especially as you're working towards failure. You know, like let's say a one-arm dumbbell row. I like watch people kind of grab it or they, you know, do a thumb over and they're looking for like their most advantageous grip because they don't want to wear it out. And I'm like, dude, the strength in the grip, like that to me, when I squeeze as hard as I can, that's when I start feeling everything. And I think like that, especially on the arms, you know, if you're doing like, like let's say you're doing like a cable curl with a, you know, let's say a straight bar or a V bar or just something, like actually squeezing it as hard as you can actually lights up the bicep. And then, you know, and so whenever people are like, oh, I don't really feel these, I'm like, I want you to squeeze as hard as you can and just kind of hold it for a second and then come through. So, I mean, just some little tricks like that, that a lot of people don't really think about. Or like the other one too, we were doing the other day was like incline chest supported dumbbell rows. And actually like getting full extension, really getting the lat to stretch and then coming all the way back. So really understanding what full extension it is. And then really understand, like we said, those, you know, two drivers, mechanical tension and working towards failure, but then also realizing that muscle damage is not a driver for hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the CrossFit. You remember there was a brand that was called like Live Sore? Mm-hmm. That like their whole thing was like, this is how you, you know, become great is by just being sore all the time. Mm-hmm. Soreness is not a driver for hypertrophy. It's not a driver for strength. It's not a driver for anything. It's just, a receipt for doing too much stupid shit. And so those guys were like, live sore. And they were trying to relate being sore to athletic performance. And I'm like, I'm not going to buy in on that one. But yeah, those were just one of the many, many brands that were built in the CrossFit ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, and even, you know, we talk about failure as one of the drivers. That's really just a vehicle to get to mechanical tension, right? You kind of mentioned that before. It's like, and as you were talking through those, I think about hex press. I think that if we were to audit all of the movements we have people do, I think hex press is the one that gets overlooked. Like the nuance gets overlooked because you have to really get everything out of it, you have to actively be smashing the dumbbells together as you're pressing, right? And I think a lot of people just focus on, okay, I'm pressing with my dumbbells towards the inside of my chest. And it's like, no, if you really smash that, you feel that inner pec light up in a unique way. And then once that starts to go, once that starts to fail, man, I could do hex press with 30 pound dumbbells. And if you're squeezing hard enough, that gets pretty spicy. Right. And so, I think that's the failure aspect is just a way to get to more mechanical tension. But yeah, the soreness, it's like, actually, I would prefer to never be sore because if I'm too sore, you know, if I blow myself up on Monday, well then Tuesday's workout's going to take a hit because I just can't hit the intensity that I need to. And so the soreness is something that we want to avoid, which, and again, looking at the Hammer 90 folks, I think a lot of that's cleared up more with nutrition than anything. I think, you know, cause this week has been a especially heavy week and we're rounding into the last month, and the chatter on Discord is about how everybody's feeling really crushed. But then they're going in and still hitting, like, MCK just texted me. He's like, man, I don't know. I think today's going to be a light day. After the fact, he's like, I PR'd my hip thrust 515. And it's like, okay. Like, you know, so
nice.
It's like,
nice. Nice.
You know, I think a lot of that gets cleaned up on nutrition, which we're going to talk about at the seminar as well, because I think that's another area historically and kind of dogmatically just gets butchered. I think people think hypertrophy, well, that's a green light to just eat whatever I want. And then they have folks, you know, like Sam Sulik of the world who are not them, right? Sam Sulik is like a different, he's an outlier among us. And he talks about, like, oh, during his bulking phase, he's eating like pints of Ben and Jerry's. And it's like, yeah, well, two things are going on there. One, he's 24 years old.
Yeah.
And the dude's on a lot of, you know, a lot of gas, which is cool. Like, that's totally also fine. But it's like,
the one thing I do give him a big head tap in on is, he does some form of aerobic work every single day fast.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so for sure.
Even in the off season, I think in the off season he does, you know, 30 minutes, you know, first thing in the morning. And I think during season or when he starts getting in shape, I think he pushes it out multiple sessions. So I think he's pretty sharp in that, you know, he kind of figured out that, you know, total caloric load is the major driver. I mean, if you eat enough pro, like, and the other thing too, and I'm sure we can, you know, we'll go into this in greater detail at the seminar, but the protein requirements, I think, have been kind of overblown. You know, they went back and looked, and I think it's, you know, right at that 0.8 kilograms, you know, like, what is it, 0.8?
Yeah, it's 1.6 grams per kilo, so 0.8 grams per pound, roughly. Yeah,
it's kind of the is really the like the minimal, or I guess like the max, how do you say that? Minimal, maximal. I mean, that's really the effective dose. I mean, they didn't really see, and I've seen this too, when we all of a sudden start pushing it out to, you know, John Anderson, who was, you know, something like, you know, 3 grams of protein per pound of body weight and was trying to eat 900 pounds of protein. And I'm just sure his fucking gas was legendary. I know we had him on the podcast. He was sitting there farting because he had his wife in the back, and I could see the look, like her turning her head. And like, he's like, oh, that 900 grams of protein is really fucking not up my stomach. But, you know, that's a pretty interesting one because people were jamming so much protein and, you know, and the appearance a lot of times, especially with the carbs, you know, carbs are a major driver for hypertrophy, and especially in that training space, giving you the energy you need. I mean, constantly going in the gym carb depleted. It is tough. I mean, you know, I had Sean Baker on the podcast and, you know, he just eats steaks, even though we were at Soreness and I did watch him have a piece of cake. we went to the VIP dinner and like we were eating steaks and then he came over with a piece of cake and I looked at him and I was like, He's like, I know. He's like, I do enjoy a piece of cake on occasion. And I was like, well, good. I'm glad you're not a complete weirdo. And, you know, but I asked him, I'm like, you know, I've done ketogenic diets. I've done, you know, mainly a meat diet, and, it just gets to be very monotonous, especially in the training. And, you know, you kind of tend to lose those pumps and a little bit of that energy. So I definitely think that I'm not giving people a license to eat, you know, fucking like Lee Priest and those guys were eating like 1200 grams of carbohydrate, but you definitely need carbs in the diet. And I think that's the one thing that I've seen with Hammer 90 is curing people of their carb phobia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, cause it's, again, a lot of, if we talk about hypertrophy training, a lot of it comes out of the bodybuilding world. And, because of the regulations or the allowances in that sport, people can be on, you know, certain drugs and certain performance enhancers that allow them to both push volume of training to a higher degree, but also allows them because of that to consume kind of extreme diets. Right. And when we're talking about the every person, they see that and they think I need to do that. But the reality is, it's like, we're not operating with that kind of machinery, right? There, our hardware is not the elite bodybuilders' hardware, but we can look to what those folks are doing. And so again, what was it? Jay Cutler, I think was, you had him on the pod and he talked about just the massive amount of carbs he was eating. He's like, okay, do we need to eat those exact ratios or sorry, those exact amounts? No, but can we look at his ratios there? Right. Yeah. If somebody who is arguably one of the biggest people in the sport, in the history of the sport, eats so many carbs, that should tune us into, hey, maybe carbs are pretty important for this, this whole endeavor.
You know, having Jay on the podcast was really interesting. I mean, the fact that he just did 4 sets of 10 of every single movement and, he wrote the program, picked these movements and did 4 sets of 10. And while he kind of said it at first, it kind of shocked me, but then I was like, you know what? I guarantee he was doing some form of progressive overload. You know, he was coming in and he's like, you know, I was doing 4 sets of 10 of this movement and then I added weight to the bar. So, I mean, he was basically just doing a linear progression, you know, from like, you know, 4 sets of 10 instead of like, hey, I'm going to try to do 8. When I get to 9, when I get to 10, then I'm going to load more weight and I'm going to go back to 8, which is kind of how we do it, is you kind of stair step up the, up to, you know, the reps until you hit the heavy weight. And then, you know, once you fail, you go back down and kind of go all over again. But, you know, him just doing 4 sets of 10 kind of blew my mind. But then also talking about, you know, the ability to process, like he was working, I think, with like Chris Aceto, and, you know, he was really big on carbs and was trying to get him to eat like 1,000 grams of carbohydrates a day. And,
sounds beautiful. Sounds glorious.
Well, he was eating meals like, and like there was a pretty cool, you know, cause they like back in the day, all those guys, you know, before social media were super private, but they always had some like one biographer guy who would kind of video him. And there was a video of like them waking him up at like 5 a.m. to go do his cardio. And he's like, oh, I'm so tired. I was up at 2 a.m. trying to get my 8th meal.
Oh my God.
And, I was like, and you know, dude, he, you know, and he also lived on the step mill. So his step mill was like 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour at night. So, I mean, they're eating all this food. He's probably, you know, doing step mill for 1 hour, eating, training, eating, going back and training, and then finishing in step mill. And, you know, just the volume of work he's doing is really high, but I don't think his intensity, like he never worked to legitimate failure, kind of like a Dorian Yates. He was just 4 sets of 10 and, you know, kind of a, you know, but he's super healthy and, you know, it just means that like there's more than one way to skin a cat. Not everybody has to do it the same way. I mean, I remember, and I've told the story on the podcast, my roommate in college, Kevin Doherty, had the Blood and Guts videotapes for Dorian Yates. And he like brings them in. He also had all the West Side kind of bench and squat and deadlift videos. And we were watching that Blood and Guts. And that was probably one of the more impactful things for me, for the fact that I was like, oh, it's not just 4 sets of 5 or 4 sets of 6. Yeah. Because, you know, like, we would just pick a weight and do it like, oh, they want us to do 6 or 8 times, and just do it 6 or 8. And then when I was watching him and like the last rep, what I would notice, the first one would be fast and second. And then all of a sudden you'd watch the last rep and then the bar speed would stop and you'd see the shake and then he would drive through it. And then as I got into, you know, into college and was doing the nutrition stuff, we got into all the physiology and you started understanding like that's what really tension is creating, is when that, when the bar slows down and the muscle starts really having to, you know, recruit all the motor units to push, that's where the byproduct, and that's what that byproduct of hypertrophy comes from.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think a lot of us have gone through that same kind of evolution. Cause we, in high school we did like the Husker Power, and it's like, The first month we did tens, the next month we did fives, and then the next month we did like 3-2 singles.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, yeah, you learn a little bit more and you realize there's just a lot of gray area in this. And that's kind of the problem now. I always talk about, like, I miss when fitness was just listening to the old dude in the back of the gym who'd been there for a long time. Cause it's like that guy just had it figured out cause he'd seen it all. Right. Yeah. But the problem now is with social media and the algorithm and how that works, we get hit with like all of these absolutes and all of these like black and whites, and it has to be this way. And it's like, you know, it doesn't. And, but people get information overload. So then they get paralyzed, right? They don't know what to do. And then they end up just doing something ineffective because they can't, you know, they're afraid to push too hard. Cause maybe they saw, some PT on Instagram talk about how you're going to get injured, but then, you know, they think, oh, I need to push really hard because they hear somebody talking about failure, and then they overshoot and they do end up hurting themselves. And it's just like this whole thing. So,
well, I think what it comes down to too is you have to have the foundation to build upon, right? Like you have to be in shape, you know, and as I've said this for years, as much as I shitted on building aerobic base and being in shape and you just need to sprint and lift weights, I was wrong. And I'll gladly walk that one back. But being in shape with a base level of GPP, and that, I'll tell you, that's the one thing I did learn from CrossFit. That GPP wasn't a sport. So to say that the sport of GPP is kind of an oxymoron, but understanding that base level of conditioning. When I first got exposed to the CrossFit deal, I had to go back and read Super Training. And I think there was Zadiskorsky, Science and Practice had a little bit in there too about like circuits and kind of like a different preparatory phase. And it's, you know, why we ended up doing the Nebraska circuits was that you're trying to build this foundation in which to build upon. And he even says in there, you know, GPP can be a lot of fun and it's base level of fitness and getting people in shape. But at some point, you have to start transitioning into more specific, like you can't stay in the GPP phase forever, which even though CrossFit claimed to be the sport of GPP, what those guys were doing was SPP. And just going back and understanding like how all of these fit together made me realize that like you got to have a base level of conditioning. If you want to put on muscle, you want to be strong, you want to do it, you have to be able to do it with enough consistency, which requires you to be in shape, eat enough calories, sleep well. And, you know, if you have the ability to supplement into this stuff, you know, with supplements, but also the missing element that these guys have is the drug stuff. You know, I mean, we didn't talk about that on the podcast with Jay Cutler, but I've heard him talk about it since then. Those guys, you know, like when you're taking that volume of drugs, it allows you to do some superhuman things like digest, you know, more calories, hopefully sleep a little bit better, and then get more relative intensity in the gym. I mean, the... Like, I think they did it's funny, I've seen two conflicting studies. One, I think they took men and put them into an workout program, like lifted weights, and they took another group and just gave them testosterone. And the guys that took testosterone ended up putting on more muscle than the guys that were lifting weights, right? But like, that's such a shitty study because you don't, like one, you don't really know what they were doing in the gym. I mean, they can see what you're doing in the gym, but like, what were they really doing? I mean, they could have been in there just not lifting the right weights, I mean, or the right percentages. But I did think that was pretty interesting. Like, is testosterone going to put on muscle? No, not alone. But it's going to allow you to drive the car a little bit harder so that you can effectively get where you need to go. And the training still has to be right. Like, just taking drugs isn't just some, like, people think it's like, oh, I'm going to take drugs and be jacked. No, you actually have to do the work. And that was Louis Simmons. Like, I never see what did he say? I never saw a bottle of test squat 1,000 pounds. And, I was like, that's true, but you're also giving these guys 3 grams of test and they're in the fucking bathroom ready to rip the door off. I told you about that story with Nate.
Yeah.
Where those, so I take for you guys now, you know, Louis has since passed. So we can tell the story. I take Nate out to Westside. We were out there for, I think it was like 17, 20 days or whatever it is, a couple weeks. And the first time we go to squat on a Friday for their max effort, all the guys like are kind of like, you know, getting ready, warming up. And then they all march into the bathroom and shut the door. And like Nate's like looking at me, he's like, what are they doing? I'm like, I don't know. Either they're in there having sex or they're like doing coke. And he's like, how do you know? And then all of a sudden, as soon as he said, how do you know? It got kind of quiet. And I heard this like, and then I heard, oh, and then they tried to kick the door off the hinges. And those guys came storming out there like berserkers ready to murder a village in, you know, the Middle Ages. And like, all of a sudden the music went up and like these dudes started like, you know, banging their head into the bars. There was blood. One dude squats, comes up with 1,000, his nose explodes and there's like a pool of blood everywhere. And these dudes are absolutely fucking going. And Nate was like, what's going on here? I'm like, dude, welcome to the penitentiary. I mean, it was probably one of the most intense environments I've ever seen for the fat. And like, I just love it. Nate was like, what are they doing in there? I'm like, and as soon as he said it, it was like, you know, just blowing, they're blowing rails and doing a bunch of coke or meth or whatever they were doing. And then they came out and absolutely killed these fucking weights.
Yeah.
Like to see people come and move that fast with like 1300 pounds was absolutely insane.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, again, that's another case of a lot of this information comes from those elites that are doing superhuman things, but they have aid to do those superhuman things. Right. And that's one thing I think that we're softening on a little bit. The conversation around drugs and androgens and things like that is, it's softening a bit, which I think is a good thing because then it lets us have more honest conversation, right? Because for the longest time there, even the bodybuilders, it's like, oh no, like I'm clean. And, you know, like the Hulk Hogan, like I drink my milk, eat my vitamins, say my prayers, right? And that's, and it's like that, making it that kind of disingenuous or putting it behind that kind of like curtain doesn't let us have these honest conversations, right? Because now we know like, okay, if you're enhanced, sure, we can do all sorts of things. But if you're not enhanced, then we just have to kind of take the concepts, but pare it down. Because the biggest thing, is the recovery. Like if you're on those, you know, if you're on the performance enhancers, you can recover for every day. So then you can bring it every day. But if you're not and you're, you know, an average person working a 40-hour week job, got kids at home, things like that, it's like you have to know that regardless of your best intentions and whatever desires you have, you're just not going to be able to bring it every day or on every lift. And so understanding how to navigate that on your own, I think is an important deal for this kind of long-term, because ultimately it's just consistency too, right? Like if we lift heavy weights on a consistent enough basis for a long enough timeline, you're going to get big. But people want to like fast track it because they have no concept of that timeline when you're in a natural state. And it's like, man, you know, we got a couple, Sandy and Andrew Wagstrom, who did the first Hammer 90, crushed it. They both got down to single digits, came into this Hammer 90, still in single digits. And they're like, oh, I can't do anything more. I can't go down anymore. And it's like, okay, so I'm kind of beta testing a lean bulk nutrition protocol with them. And
how's he doing?
But both of them are doing great. Sandy had a little bit of a wild ride in the beginning, but he's good now. And then
did he get injured?
No, he had like some health stuff pop up. Just like, I don't know. He's a wild man.
Yeah.
Still was in the gym though. And he's like, they put me on these steroids and my face is so inflamed, but I'm still hitting it. Like, you're the man. You're wild. But I have both those guys nutritionally doing like a lean bulk and it's slow, man. And these guys are single digit body fat. They both train with a lot of intensity. I know they're putting in the work, but gaining lean mass or gaining muscle is so slow compared to weight loss, right? Yeah. Weight loss, 3 months, you know, we had people dropping 10%+ of their body weight.
Yeah.
You want to put on 10% of your body weight and lean mass? You got to pack it up for years, man. Like that takes a long time. So,
well think about how much, think about how much muscle you can put on a certain day. That's kind of like one of those like interesting things when you ask people, you're like, how much, okay, like let's say everything's perfect. How much muscle do you think you could put on in a single day? Like a few grams?
Yeah, maybe, I mean, right?
Think about like, if you're, you know, there's a difference between like the newbie gains, right? Like when you first lift weights, obviously, but then as you train and you get more volume underneath you, like, you know, what are you maybe going to put on a pound or 2 pounds a year? And you divide that by 365 days and you look at all these training and it's literally just like fractions of grams. And, you know, people, I think, at least in my personal view, it was a lot easier to put on all that muscle when I was in my teens and my 20s. And even in my 30s, you know, I think strength really peaked somewhere around 26, 28 is really when my strength peaked. And, you know, I was still very consistently strong into my 30s. And, you know, but it's a lot easier to put on all of that muscle and have that when you diet down, you're like, oh, okay, I'm still pretty happy with it. But if you didn't spend the time putting on that muscle, sometimes when you lean out, you're not always real happy with what you see underneath.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's something I think that can be frustrating for folks. Right. And it's like, yeah, if we all had a time machine, we'd do things differently. But the reality is if you really didn't get into lifting weights until your 30s, 40s, you know, which some of our folks, they're just late to the game. And, You just have to understand, okay, you've now missed that, you know, that window where you're just a walking ball of testosterone, right? But if you're lifting heavy weights, I've seen plenty of people who, and you probably have as well, who were like the big time athlete in high school. And then during college kind of took some time off, whatever. Now they're 35, 36 years old and they want to get back into it. They can still look pretty jacked once they diet back down. But if you're somebody who really didn't get into lifting weights or heavy weights until, you know, your mid 30s or so, you're just probably never going to have that kind of Adonis-like physique, right? Because you just missed the window of some serious growth. But that doesn't mean that you can't still maximize what you have left, right? You can still put on muscle. You're just probably not going to look, you know, like the things you see on social media, but you can still look much better than you do now, or you can still have much more lean mass than you do now. But again, it just takes time because, you know, you and I, when we were teenagers, I lifted weights, 4 days a week in school. We had weightlifting class where we lifted 4 days a week, and then we had sports lifting. It's like, man, but it was cool because I was 16 years old and, you know, recovered in hours. And yeah. And so it's like, you could just do that then.
Yeah.
But now even the thought of that, it's like, man, if I did that now, I would probably make it 3-4 days with that training volume I was doing. And then I would have to take a week off. Right.
So in high school, I trained with these older guys, this guy named Tasso Papadakis. His brother Petros is a newscaster and kind of a local celebrity in Southern California. They both played for USC. And so I went to school with Tasso and Petros. And Tasso was like the strongest kid in America under 16. He had like it was 5'10 for 10 on the back squat at 15 and 3'15 wow. for 10 at 15. He looked like wow. a fucking superhero. And like, you know, like pre-social media, if their social media had existed, and you had seen like a 15-year-old kid who looked like that, was that physically strong, like people would have lost their minds. And he's a good looking dude. He was my training partner. And what the guys did is they would eat their lunch quick and then they would go lift weights at lunch and fifth period. And then obviously sixth period for football, we would do all of our training stuff. So mm-hmm. they were like, hey, if you want to train with us, we start at lunch. And I was like, well, I have a fifth period class. And they're like, yeah, you need to get rid of that. So I went to my counselor and I was like, hey, how do I get rid of fifth period? And she's like, well, you need all these classes. These guys are older than you. I was like, well, is there anything I can do? She's like, you can take zero period. I'm like, done. So they switched me into a zero period. So I started school at 7 so I could get done by fourth period and then lift weights at lunch, fifth period, and then sixth period. And then we would leave there after sixth period and we would drive to 24-hour fitness. Mm-hmm. And so it was like you're talking like 2 hours, then football, then getting in yeah. the car and then doing another 45 minutes of whatever hell we were doing at the gym. And we pretty much did that 5 days a week. And then Sundays we'd go to Zangus and squat.
Yeah.
So it was yeah, 6 days. It was bananas and like no idea on like volume and intensity or everything. It was just pick a movement and do it as many times as you can to failure. And then next time try to do a little bit heavier. I don't even remember there was no meals in between any of this either.
Well, that's the thing too, right? Yeah. I wasn't worried about getting my post-workout nutrition in. Cause I did the same thing. I got a work release when you're a sophomore in high school, you could get a work release for the second half of the day at some point. And so I got a work release cause I worked at the YMCA as a lifeguard, but I would get a work release and I would go up to their little weight room and I did the same thing. I just did one a couple sets at every one of the machines. Didn't know what I was doing, but I did that in addition to the weights. And then, yeah, I wouldn't eat dinner until like 8 p.m. because I had practice after school and things like that. And back then dinner was, you know, not what we would consider like a nutrient dense diet now, but you're just young and you're made of rubber and you're invincible and, you know, that's the benefit of hitting heavy weights early. And if you miss that window, well, then we just have to maximize with what we have. And we can still do a lot of work, but we just have to recognize it's different now. You have life obligations and stressors and things that are going to maybe compromise or make you have to alter the plan, right? Because that's the other thing I know you run into a lot. It's like people we'll say stuff about like, oh, I really wish XYZ was in the program. And it's like, man, these programs are written for thousands of people. It's like, what's the kind of most broad stroke we can make for the most people? But if you want to personalize it, well, then you have to take the time to really understand what you need. And that's another reason why I'm stoked for these folks coming down for the seminar, because we're going to go through, you know, we have all those practical sessions. So they're going to be able to feel exactly what we're talking about. And they're going to be able to go through exactly what we talk about. So then they can make that connection of like, oh, these are maybe some changes I should make when I get back to my garage or whatever.
Yeah. The physiology is pretty basic, right? We get into the drivers for it, for mm-hmm. hypertrophy. I want to talk a bunch about motor unit recruitment, you know, effort versus load, and like working proximity to failure. And then the three levers we have, which are volume, intensity, and frequency. And mm-hmm. understanding like what does total volume need to look like over a week to drive? And more importantly, like understanding the idea of, you know, some form of linear progression or just progressive overload. I mean, it's really mm-hmm. like the main factor, right? Like the only way you're going to get there. The other thing, which I've seen a direct relationship to, is strength and hypertrophy. When I was doing all the consults, and I know you did a bunch of consults too, for those that were, you know, signing up for our annuals. As I got through the consult, one of the interesting things is one of the guys said to me, he's like, you know, I don't think I put on any muscle recently. And I was like, what's recently? He's like, the last year, maybe two. And I was like, well, have you been getting stronger? And he's like, well, why does that matter? I'm like, you're not tracking your lifts. Like, he's like, no, I just go in there and I kind of hit it. I'm like, you have to track your lifts. How do you know if you're getting stronger? And he's like, well, you know, I want to put on muscle. I'm like, dude, there's a direct relationship between strength mm-hmm. and muscle. There's a good chance that if you're not PRing your lifts, or at least adding a rep, or, you know, adding a few ounces, or, you know, a few pounds or whatever it is, if you're not getting stronger, there's a good chance that you're not driving the adaptation, because really what we're doing is we're driving adaptation to put on muscle, and strength is directly related to it. So if you're not getting stronger in the weight room, there's a good chance you're not putting on muscle. If you're telling me, man, I'm getting really strong, I'm, you know, I did this for six and now I'm doing it for seven and I added weight, like those people aren't nervous about, and they're not complaining about putting on muscle. They're getting bigger mm-hmm. and stronger, and there's a direct relationship for it. So I want to get into those three levers: volume, intensity, and frequency. Fatigue versus stimulus. Like, we need to stimulate and drive adaptation. But if you're just throwing junk volume on to add fatigue, mm-hmm. trying to work in on the backside so that, you know, junk volume back sets. And then really just the key takeaway is effective reps build muscle, not just, you know, more reps. Like, and I think that's yeah. where people like, you know, get into this. Like, it's really like effectively, like those effective reps are the ones, and really those high, you know, high neurologically recruiting movements and those reps. So that's what we're driving for.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier about the chest supported rows. Mm-hmm. And that's a movement. There's a lot of movements out there where I don't think people understand it, the idea of, to really make it an effective rep, you have to maintain control through the entirety of the movement. Right. And I think about rows a lot, because rarely when I see people post videos about it, do they show any kind of pause at that full contraction, right? With the row all the way up, they don't show any control there. They're just kind of like rip it and let it go back down. And I'm not saying you have to do like 3 second eccentrics on every rep, but if you're not showing control, that means you're not contracting the muscle, which means you're not producing force and all that. So that's the other thing. Yeah. I think people couch it as like, oh, I'll just do a lot of volume. And it's like, yeah, but if you're only really producing force for 40% of the force curve of the lift, then you're missing out on a lot of the stimulus needed. And that's where somebody like a Jay Cutler doing, oh, only four sets of 10, dude, I bet he was hammering all of those reps with, you know, phenomenal control and feeling tension through the entire rep. And that's kind of like back to the movement selection too. It's like, yeah, you do need to feel a little bit, because you need to be able to know, am I producing force right now? Or am I just going through these motions?
Yeah. Shit. I totally forgot what I was going to say. All right. The ability to, what the hell was it?
We were talking about effective reps. Well, while you're thinking, go on.
Yeah, no. Oh, well, what I was going to say is another cool piece of research that came in is they looked at your ability to put on muscle focusing on different, you know, muscle reps, right? Like, so like they looked at concentric, isometric and eccentric, mm-hmm. and there was no hypertrophy effect for eccentrics or isometrics. Everything was driving towards concentric. So then mm-hmm. when you talk to people and you tell them that, like, well, should I only do concentric movements? And it's like, no, there's other things that happen with the eccentrics, right? You can't, like, you're talking about like the remodeling of tissue, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all the foam rolling and all the, you know, tempering you want to do isn't going to remodel tissue. The only way you're going to remodel tissue is with heavy eccentrics. and where, you know, we look at tendon strength and connective tissues and all of those supporting functions happen under the eccentric load. Now, the isometrics is where you develop a ton of stability. So, you know, getting into a position, stabilizing and developing those stabilizers. So being really smooth, you know, control the eccentrics and realizing that I'm overloading, building connective tissues and tendons and really just kind of stretching that stuff. And then, you know, the eccentric, the control of the isometric in different positions, showing control and stability, and then really driving through on that concentric movement as the driver for hypertrophy. So it's kind of funny, man. Like, as people are like, oh, you know, the only muscle contraction that drives hypertrophy is concentric. And then, of course, everybody's like, all we should do is concentric. You know, so then you got guys that are pushing and then somebody's dropping the bar back down and they're not really doing it. And I'm like, no. These all three work together in an amazing concert. Just because these other two don't drive hypertrophy doesn't mean that their contribution isn't as big in terms of neurological efficiency and rewiring and muscle, you know, and remodeling of tissue.
Yeah. And the other thing I was going to mention, I like that guy who said, you know, I haven't put any muscle on. I think you remember like maybe 10, 15 years ago, and kind of CrossFit chirped about this a lot. People would say like, oh, bodybuilders have a lot of muscle, but they're not very strong. And it's like, now that we have social media and you can see these guys train, it's like, these dudes are pretty freaking strong too, right? Like, it's not like they're just doing 20-pound bicep curls to get huge arms. And so I think there was just a misunderstanding or kind of a, you know, like a urban legend that like, oh yeah, they have a lot of muscle, but it's not really strong muscle. And it's like, what, like, I don't even understand how that could mean, like how that could be possible. How could you just have a ton of lean mass, but not let it contract? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. So yeah, if you get big, you're going to get strong. You can get strong without being big, right? We see that all the time. Little wiry dudes who are like freakishly strong. But if you're getting bigger, you have to get stronger. You might not have figured out how to express that, but it's like, if we shot a tens unit on your muscle, it would produce a lot of tension if you have a lot of muscle. So that's something that, I don't know, it just always interests me when people say that. I think it's like a jealousy thing. I think because they're not big, they're like, oh yeah, well, I don't want to be big because they're not really strong. It's like, no,
well, the, so there's, I think there's genetic outliers in this thing. Because years ago when I was in high school, we used to periodically drive down to Venice Gold just because we wanted to see the bodybuilders. You know, we were like, you know, old man Zangus owned Marathon Nutrition and he would advertise in all the magazines. So they would obviously send him a bunch of them. So he had just had like stacks of magazines. And, you know, we would like, you know, as we were lifting weights or training, like we didn't have phones to fuck around in between sets. And there might be like five guys squatting, you know, they got to wrap their knees and it just takes a while. So we would just sit and like flip through these magazines. And all the bodybuilding magazines always were, you know, the center of the photo shoot was always Venice Gold. So then it became this idea of like, man, it's only like, you know, 60 minutes away. And, you know, like we should go out there. So we would go out there and it was kind of neat. You go in and there was this like big, massive, like big Mike dude at the front, just like eating a bowl of like rice peas and chicken and mayonnaise, you know, and like, you know, just you walk in, it's just like a wave of like protein drinks and just terrible gas. And I just remember like these big bodybuilders just farting up a storm everywhere we went, just getting crop dusted. And you go in, you know, pay the fee, and there's like Sean Ray and these dudes just like were like double parked in like the fire lanes and these crazy cars. And so we go in, and one of the guys that we saw was Paul Dillette, who, if you guys Google him, was just an absolute freak. He did not lift heavy weights. Everything was like, you know, 60% of one RM. And he just did like sets of 20 and 30. And the guy was a genetic freak. I mean, just an outlier. I also think too, for a lot of those guys, certain people respond better to the drugs than other people do. I mean, to be a pro bodybuilder, you have to be, you know, genetically gifted, you know, and whether it looks like a receptor sites or whatever, and then they take drugs and certain guys respond differently to the drugs than other guys. I mean, you know, there's guys that, you know, take the same amount of drugs as a Jay Cutler and never win a local show. And you have a guy like Jay Cutler take, you know, this and wins Mr. Olympias. So it was really different. It was interesting to go up and see the different body types and how we're paying, how people were training. There were some bodybuilders in there that were absolutely lifting just insane poundages. Like these dudes were just like put every plate on the gym. And I look over and this dude's like got like 35-pound dumbbells and he's over there for like an hour doing bicep curls and shoulder stuff. And like, I thought he was warming up, and the dude was literally just drenched in sweat. And then he left. Next time we went in there, he was walking on the treadmill at like maybe like a 3 to 5% incline for maybe a speed of like 3 miles an hour. And he walked on that thing for probably, we were there 2 hours, nonstop for 2 hours.
Jeez.
I mean, just like, it was the craziest thing. I'm like, God damn, dude, dude's over there with 30 pound dumbbells walking on an incline for 3 hours, you know?
So he's doing like silver sneaker stuff.
Yeah. And that guy was a massive dude, but then some of those other guys were just absolute monsters. So it just means that like everybody's kind of getting to the same place and how they're skinning it. But, you know, you also heard me say for years that in the NFL, I could tell you without a doubt, there was a remarkable difference between dudes that lifted over 85% and those that didn't. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. I just, it was night and day. Like if I saw a guy train in the gym and I saw what he did, like I was never off. You see a dude take his shirt off and you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And there are a lot of guys that I knew guys that never put more than 315 on a bar, whether it be a back squat, a deadlift or a bench press. And they were, you know, offensive lineman, 300 pounds. And like you could see in the development, the dudes that lifted heavy weights were not only more explosive, just physically looked the part. Because the thing is there's no way to lift heavy weights without the supporting features, right? You're going to like lift heavy. You got to have big traps. You got to have big shoulders. You got to be strong and a lot. And it like there's not just looking strong. I mean, I guess some people look strong and aren't strong, but I've very rarely seen people that were real strong that didn't at least look the part.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's if you've been around this stuff long enough, people can tell you whatever they want to tell you, but you can, it's like the eyeball test tells all, right? The same thing. We would see it at seminars when people sprinted, right? It's like, oh, you've never sprinted. This is the first time you've ever sprinted. Same thing with lifting heavy weights. It's like, if you do it consistently long enough, you look a certain part. And that's not to say everybody who does it is huge, right? Because there are genetics do play a huge role in this, right? If your dad was 150 pounds soaking wet and your mom was 90 pounds, you're probably not going to be a 225 jack behemoth, right? But you can still look at people and say, yeah, just the structure of them, you can tell like, oh, you lift weights on a regular basis. And so when some of these people say like, oh man, I just can't get stronger. I can't get, you know, I can't put on muscle. It's like, well, you don't need to tell me what you're doing, 'cause I can see what you're not doing just based off how kind of your physique looks, even if you're not shredded. 'Cause that's the other part, right? The shredded is nutrition. The walking around in single digits, that's not from lifting the weights. That's from the nutrition side of things. But lifting the weights, oh, your back's a little bit broader. I like to look at the calves, right? Because there's like two different people who lift weights that have calves. There's like the fat guys, and they got like the calves that are like 40 inches around.
I'm super jealous.
Yeah, I mean, that Durrett and I talk about it all the time. The best thing you could have
is to be obese. Development is to be obese when you're younger. Yeah, yeah. It's funny. Like Johnny Durrett's a classic example. He's got great calves, and he's like, yeah, I was fat for a really long time. Like, you got to build those things. What's kind of funny is, dude, and you guys will laugh at this because I remember it was like a dagger in my heart when I went to go do Mark Bell's podcast. They had me doing a bunch of like, I took him through a bunch of band kind of movement stuff. And some guy was like, what's wrong with his calves? And I used to have pretty nice calves. And I used to make fun of people all the time and be like, what's wrong with your calves? And I was like, you know, I had pretty good ones. And then when I got my leg broke, I took that helmet to the shin. You know, they cast me 5 days. I played like 3 weeks later on this broken leg. We're playing Indianapolis. And, you know, obviously the fibula was still kind of splintered. All of a sudden put my calf in spasm. And it felt like somebody kicked me. And I came out and I was like, dude, something's wrong with my calf. And the doctor like looked at it. He's like, you get up on your toes. You're fine. You know, go back. You just probably got kicked. All of a sudden we come in the next day. It's all black and blue. And they were like, oh, you just got kicked. And then as the swelling went down, all of a sudden there's a massive divot. My calf, I ruptured the soleus. And all of a sudden I was like, fuck. And then I had one good calf. And I was like, well, at least I got one, you know, tell people I'm injured. And then when my knee got hurt and I started losing extension, I couldn't get the calf to fire. It started like decreasing. And I was like, this is why you don't make fun of people's calves. And you sure as hell don't make fun of their hairlines or anything else that they can't change. And so I'm in this text thread with like Dave Spitz and all the guys. And Dave always makes comments about like, you know, like, hey, like we're older and we got way better hairlines than you. And I keep telling him, I'm like, you know, it's because these young guys like don't have good hairlines. I'm like, dude, stop making fun of him. I'm not jumping in on this. You saw what happened to my calves.
Yeah, karma will get you on that. Yeah,
karma's a motherfucker. Well, I think it's God's way of just humbling you in certain ways. It's like, you know what? Yeah. You know, you're going to do this. Let me fucking get back at you.
Yeah. Yeah. You think so? Yeah. No, all that to say, like, genetics do play a big part in this. So people, I hope we can have those conversations at the seminar too, to let people understand what lens they should put on when they're looking at themselves and their training and kind of desired outcomes, because, you know, some people just have the inherited architecture to look a certain way. You know, I come from a line of a whole bunch of Eastern Europeans. I'm going to look like a rectangle forever. You know, I'm not going to get super tapered, but that's just because those guys, that's what they do. They just look stout like that. Right. So it is, I mean, getting people just to understand, because for whatever reason, I feel like hypertrophy is still the most like, it's like hand wavy and magical. Like, people talk about it like it's some weird mystic thing. And it's like, no, like you said, the physiology is pretty straightforward. The nutrition is pretty straightforward now, pretty accessible out there.
Yeah.
It just comes down to the execution. And much like everything with weights, the only way you really learn that is by doing it and having somebody who knows what they're talking about. Again, the old guy in the back of the gym.
Yeah.
Having somebody who knows what they're talking about show you. And so bringing that to the people, I think, will be hopefully pretty, pretty fun. I mean, I know it'll be fun. I hope they enjoy it as much as I'm excited for it.
Yeah, no, it's always good to get new people in and actually do events. I mean, every time we do the collective, it's like a recharge. And, you know, it's great to see old friends and have people come in. And I think the group's really, you know, pretty evolved, you know, into the different personalities. And, like, you know, we also have all this connection. So it's neat to bring new people into the fold and come in and train a little bit. I'm just, you know, we got the space, so it's fun to do. Mm-hmm. I'm always stoked to have you guys come. We got to film some lectures, obviously, for the Academy, which is always good, and hopefully generate some content for this podcast, because as much as I enjoy, you know, looking at a screen and talking to you, it's always much more rich in person, and do it. Also, we're going to do a nutrition piece too. That's another one, mm-hmm. going into like what supplements actually work, you know, creatine, caffeine, protein. You know, I know we put together a supplement stack that you sent me that I've been testing for you. I've added, I've subtracted. I really like that pre-workout lean that you told me to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the red stuff. What is it? It's the beet powder. You kind of have to do that little mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good little pre-workout. Also, I've been kind of doing a weird linear progression on creatine to see how much creatine I can effectively absorb.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah, I've been doing like, I think I'm doing 10 grams morning, first in the morning, protein shake, and then with my pre-workout shake, and then at night before bed. And so I'm at like 30 grams, which is funny. I put it into ChatGPT, or I think it was Claude, and it was like, alert, don't do this. You're going to have all these problems. And I'm like, dude, for some reason, it's not causing me any GI distress. And I think if anything, it's helping my sleep. The other thing I think, which is helping my sleep, is I've been taking glycine.
Yeah.
And I think I got that from you. It was like 5 to 10 grams of glycine before bed.
Yeah. And that's something, you know, the supplements are really interesting because, again, much like the training, there's research, but then there's also anecdote that I do think we need to, as long as it's a reliable narrator, I think it is important to listen to anecdote. But yeah, we've been talking a lot about that on the Discord too, the sleep stuff, the glycine, the theanine, magnesium, all that stuff, just to try and like bring things down a little bit, mellow out a little bit before sleep. The pre-workout is interesting because what I often run into, because of how big I am and like guys like you, how big you are, pre-workouts for the most part are so underdosed in the stuff that matters. They usually just hinge on a bunch of caffeine and then just sprinkle in all this other stuff. So it's tough to find a well-dosed pre-workout. But actually there was a conversation in the Discord about this just yesterday. Somebody was talking about like, oh, they want to give up caffeine. And it's like, no way.
Why?
Yeah. But again, these are the kind of, you know, stories that are out there about like, oh, you should, you know, totally give up caffeine. It's like, no, it's just, you have to understand contextually when to use it, how much to use, and understand then your own tolerance for some of these things, because much like we were talking about with performance enhancers, there's responders and non-responders, right? Bill Williams and I joke because we're both morning trainers. And it's like, man, I step out the door in the morning to go to work already on like 400 milligrams caffeine. And that's, but that's just how it is. But then I know, and I'll have like a coffee on the way to work then, and maybe another one while I'm there. Nice. But I know myself, it's like, hey, when 1 o'clock PM rolls around, like I got to cut it. Otherwise I'm going to be up late, but I can, as long as I cut it by 1 PM, yeah, I can put down like 800 milligrams a day and then sleep just fine at night. And, but I know that because I pay attention to that stuff. I think a lot of this people mindlessly, they see the supplement, they look on the label and it says, take one scoop, and they're like, all right, I'm gonna take a scoop, but they don't understand what's in that scoop. So they don't really know. You know, people all the time talk about like, oh, I tried taking beta alanine, but I didn't feel anything. It's like, well, what do you think you're going to feel? Like, how do you know it's working and how much are you taking and all of that kind of stuff. So having the supplement conversation with people, I think will be really good because yeah, that's a whole, that world, people are all over the place saying good, bad, and otherwise. Have you seen the recent, like the social media trend now is people are saying they're going back on creatine and they're saying how it is going to like give us cancer and all this stuff. People are trying to make a mark like that.
Yeah, no, that crazy lady, you know, who was like doing her makeup with her like big eyes that was like, it's metabolism. And she went through this stuff and like completely batshit. I think people do shit for to gaslight people and to try to create controversy and whatnot.
Oh yeah, well, it's
easier
to get clicks.
Well, yeah, I mean, and creatine is the most researched supplement in the history of the world of supplements. Like nothing's been researched more than creatine and attacked from all sides for a number of years. And the cognitive effects that we've seen for people, especially with like Alzheimer's and dementia and this, I mean, just incredible mm-hmm. stuff. I think, you know, my brain would have been a hell of a lot worse had I not been taking creatine through my NFL career. It's funny. You know, Turley, my buddy, Kyle Turley, who I played with, mm-hmm. Kyle kind of does this thing where he kind of fades in and out. And yeah. The last time he faded in, he wanted me to help him with his marijuana company. So he was going to start a flower company. And I went in and we looked at this whole deal and I did not approve of how he wanted to do the funding. And my idea was like, I didn't like the name. I just like, there were a lot of branding pieces. And he ended up wanting to go with the name of his marijuana company called The Reverent. And he wanted the logo to be like two like nails crossed, like a, you know, like a cross. And I told him, I was like, dude, I did a bit of market research and the top marijuana companies is like fun cookies. Yeah. And like, yeah. like they're not named after the most violent movie I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. I watched The Revenant and like, I like violent movies and I like to see, like, I really dig that shit and it doesn't stress me out. That fucking moved me. Like my heart was going to explode, like the anxiety. Yeah. And like when that bear is attacking him and I left it, like walked out of that movie theater and I was like, oh my God, dude, I need to go have a drink. Like that was stressful. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm like, dude, like the most stressful, most violent movie I've ever seen. You're going to name your marijuana company. And then the logo you want to use is this like Christian, just hardcore Christian weird. Like I was like, dude, this isn't going to be a big brand. It's only going to be in like weird Christian cults in Arizona. So yeah. I came to him and I was like, dude, I want to do a brand. I want to call it Turley's and I want to hire all these cartoon artists to like make you as a cartoon and be like, hey, I'm smoking a Turley. And I kind of wanted to like brand his name associated with like a certain kind of like blunt. And, I was like, dude, this is going to be awesome. We did all the branding stuff. I did all the pitch. I went out and I wanted to raise money for it. And he's like, no, we're going with The Reverent and I'm going to personally fund it. And I was like, no, don't do that. Let's go lose other people's money. Yeah. And he got mad at me and was like, bah, you're off the team. I'm like, that's great. All right, dude, I said my piece. I'm good. So then Kyle fade out for a couple of years. Kyle came back into the picture recently. And now he is designing football equipment for like training offensive linemen. So he's got this like, you know, they're heavy bags and this kind of, it's cool. So he's been doing that. So he's been hitting me up with like ideas and whatnot. It's kind of, he fades in, but I was busting his balls because he was like showing me all his workout equipment. And I was like, hey dude, imagine if you had trained like this when you played, how much better you would have been instead of fucking off. And like when he lived in LA and we were training in Carson, I'd have to go by the house and get him because he didn't want to go train. And then he was a good training partner once he showed up, but like, and he's like, yeah, you know, and he kind of made some excuses. And I was like, imagine if you had taken creatine in the supplements like I was telling you to, you probably wouldn't be in these fucking problems. So Like that was a long story to get there, but goddamn, dude, Turley is so funny. He like fades in and out. It's like he's like a wave. He like comes out and then he comes back in, and it's always like some new idea. And he's like, man, this thing's gonna, it's gonna, you know, this thing's gonna blow up. He reminds me of my rich client. You know, this is gonna make $1 billion. I'm like, it's not gonna make $1 billion, but you might sell a little bit of it. But yeah, he's got these. He wants to make. He sent me a picture yesterday. He wants to make a big sand, like basically he wants to make a sandbag that looks like a bale of hay.
Okay.
So then the guys could like, you know, like bigger dimensions. But I was trying to explain it to him. I'm like, sandbags are super dense. Like I kind of was like, here's the ones that we created for, you know, with GORUCK, like the size of a bale of hay. I mean, bales of hay are maybe 40 inches by 40, you know, like, and you want it to be like this. I'm like, what are you going to stuff it with? Because you can't make the thing. I mean, you can't stuff it with sand, you know, like if we put rubber in it. So I kind of liked his idea, but and he actually wants it to look like a bale of hay. And I was like, that's not a bad idea. It's kind of novel. But then again, why not just go get a bale of hay?
Right. Yeah. No, you know? The strong country boys are strong because they're throwing actual bales of hay around. Well,
yeah. And if you think about the rotation, you know, like frontal plane and transverse rotation, you know, off of one leg throwing, like that's a pretty good thing. So I like that he's basically taking Field Strong because he heard me give the talk. He's like, dude, I heard this pretty rad talk you did where you're talking about like Field Strong and field work and this. And I was like, yeah, I like the program. So now he's designing these pro like different stuff. He wants to sell to offense alignment. And I was like, man, you're gonna get a bunch of little fat kids throwing bales of hay when in the gym, when in reality we could just go send them out and let them do farm work, really. It's
yeah. No, I mean, but really there was
he's like, next thing he's gonna come up with is foam anvils. He's like, we're gonna get these 3D printed foam weighted anvils to throw, you know? It's like, well, you could just go get real anvils.
Yeah. No, we should find a way to work the anvils into the seminar. We haven't busted those things out in so long.
Oh, I know.
That was a lot of fun. But yeah, no, the, back to the supplement stuff, is going to be great for folks because I think there's a lot of, mystique around it. And also, I mean, we're going to tell them the ones that kind of have the evidence behind them, but also the ones that don't, because there's a lot of those as well. But I think a lot of this, hopefully kind of from the 10,000 foot view, I just hope this brings a lot of clarity to folks, you know, because they're obviously bought into the programs and they're doing the stuff, but I hope this brings some clarity and understanding of both the intention of the program, but also just how this all works and how it's not really that complex. I mean, we could get really complex with the science and stuff, but it's not really that complex, but it is specific, right? We always fall back on the SED principle. And it's like, you have to have a specific intent when you're doing this. Otherwise, you're just going to kind of go through the motions and be better off than not doing anything, I guess. But if you're putting in the time, you might as well make it effective.
Yeah. I mean, there was a pretty remarkable difference. And I've told this story many times on the podcast. I mean, really, the history of Field Strong really came from that idea of field work. And, you know, that came my rookie year. I can't remember the dude's name, but I was playing left tackle and had this right guard or left guard I was playing next to. Wasn't a great player, but was fucking really strong. And I remember him telling me, he's like, well, I never really lifted weights. You know, I grew up on a, you know, 1,000-acre hay farm in Georgia. And, you know, playing football felt like baling hay. And like looking at him talking about the stuff that they did for their field work, you know, we got to set fence posts and this, like realizing that, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm. You know, I lifted weights and then like understanding, you know, some of that strongman and, you know, chaos theory and like the idea of like, training for chaos and like, you know, you're going to have to, if you pick up a heavy sandbag or a stone. And then there was a cool book I read like years ago. I think I might've got it off of Iron Mind that was called Dinosaur Training.
Yeah. Yeah. With the, on the cover, it's got like that barrel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that, like that dinosaur training was really, that was impactful where I realized I was like, oh man, like this was kind of the missing piece. And the funny part, and actually Turley said this to me, he's like, man, I wish we had thought about writing down our workouts and putting those out on the internet. Because, you know, we were training at Athletes Performance. We had a pretty good group. It was myself and Kyle, Marcellus Wiley, and Abby Wambach, you know, from USA Women's Soccer. And then like other people would roll in. We had a really strong group. And then like we had a bunch of other people that just kind of would come in for weeks at a time. But that core group was really good. Like the workouts we did, and like we had these, we would do these conditioning races. So we had VersaClimbers, like locked in threes, and we would do like, it was like 10 sets of like 100 like a flight of 100, and we would just kind of machine gun through and just had some really dope workouts. But, and I remember my dad telling me, you should start a website. I'm like, what am I going to put on it? He's like, I don't know. All he would have to say is like, you like to work out. Why don't you post your workouts on there and see what happens? Like, fuck.
Yeah.
I was like, God damn it. Like Glassman had the guy who invented the Nokia phone tell him that. So the way the story goes, Glassman had this real high net worth client, and he said to him, he's like, hey, these workouts we're doing, can you just put them on the internet? So if I'm not here, I can follow them. And he's like, yeah, what do we need to do? He's like, I'll design you the website. So he just put the website up. He's like, I just need you to program the workout so we can do them here. But when I'm not here, I can do them too. And he's like, that's a great idea. So that's how CrossFit started. And then people found the website, and it kind of evolved into what, I mean, shit, into a juggernaut. And, yeah, I saw CrossFit got a new CEO too.
Yeah, I don't, he was like the former COO, I think.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting, 'cause that's a, I don't know that, I don't know. I just don't know how much longer it's going to be around. But maybe he can turn the ship around. 'Cause again, without, you know, shitting on them too much, that's the entryway for a lot of folks into this style of training, right? They get a barbell in their hands for the first time, get a little bit strong. And then the natural progression is always like, man, I just kind of want to get stronger. What do I need to do? And it's like, okay, well now you need to do a little bit more structured strength and conditioning, and gets people down this pathway. It's funny, the website thing, when, 'cause when I got into CrossFit, I misunderstood the person who told me about it. I misunderstood what they said, and I looked up RossFit. And there's a guy, I'm sure actually Evan Esch knows him. Ross, I can't remember his last name, but it was the same thing. It was just a dude. He was like a boxing trainer, put workouts up. And I was like, oh, this is legit. 'Cause it was pretty cool stuff. It was like stuff I hadn't seen before, conditioning type stuff. And it is just funny how certain ones hit. I looked the other day, actually, RossFit is still up doing things, but at the time, this was back the old CrossFit website, where it was just like bare bones. It's like, man, they both were at the same place, but it's just funny how some things take off and some don't. But
I think what made CrossFit explode, there were a few things. One, Art Devaney ended up having this newsletter. It's how Rob ended up finding. I think Rob was looking online for Art Devaney stuff, and CrossFit popped up and he found it. The other one was Lauren Glassman having the wherewithal to videotape the girls' training and then putting it on with Dolly Parton music in the background.
Yeah.
Like, so they had Eva T, Annie Sakamoto, and Nicole Carroll. And those three girls were training, and they just, you know, basically just started filming these kind of like battle workout videos, which, you know, they're just, you know, throwing down on their wad. But they started filming all this stuff. And, you know, I don't think people had seen girls in that capacity. They mixed it with a little bit of music. And those original videos that she shot, I think, were one of the main drivers. And then the other moment was the most polarizing one of all, was the movie 300. So the movie like I remember watching, and I told somebody this recently, I was working, actually, I was working in the insurance brokerage. And that's a whole other story. And I had these two girls working for me. And at lunch, we went over, and where we were at, we were in South County. And like where the office was, there was like a food court and a movie theater. And as we were walking into the food court, we saw the poster for 300. And I was like, you guys want to go watch a movie? And they're like, yeah, let's go do it. So we walked in. It was like at lunchtime, right? Obviously. The movie had just opened. We sit down and we watch the movie 300. And as we're walking out, the like across the hall, the movie's starting again. And I was like, you guys want to blow off the rest of the day and go watch this fucking movie again? They were like, yes. So we sat and we watched it back to back with these. I watched with these two girls, and like the look on, I mean, I had thought like most normal people, right? Because I've been trained at Athletes Performance, and kind of like, you know, as a professional athlete, you're just kind of stuck in this ivory tower. So I just kind of assumed that like the only people that trained hard and kind of looked the part were pro athletes or people that really focused on this stuff. I just figured the average person like wanted to run a triathlon and squat in the Smith machine. And like looking at that, I was like, holy shit, dude, like this is going to change a lot of shit. And it did. Because then I think people started searching Jim Jones. And they realized that there was a very, very high barrier to entrance for Jim Jones. Like you had to like get into their cult and pay money and this, and it was all perfect. And then all of a sudden they start searching more, and it looks almost the same, but it's CrossFit for free. And all of a sudden you're like, you know, searching it, YouTube pops up, and it was really the intersection of the movie 300, Facebook, and the early days of YouTube and video, like all of those in CrossFit. like CrossFit literally hit it, that like that polarizing moment of like 2006, 2007. And like once that happened, man, it exploded. And, you know, and then, you know, years later, it's just, it like you could not have timed that better. There was like, it was the explosion of the social media thing.
Well, and it helped that cause like CrossFit, I want to say he's in Pennsylvania. It helped that CrossFit was based somewhere where people walked around in, you know, board shorts with no shirt on, or women were walking around in their bikinis on a year long basis. Right. Cause that was the other thing, was like, man, kind of like the 300 stuff. It's like, I can look like that, but they had so many photos. Remember, like every day they put up a photo of somebody doing like a one arm handstand on the beach, just looking, you know, muscular. But yeah, it's just interesting how it all happens. I remember I got in 2007, I think, a copy of Men's Health magazine, and they had the 300 guys, and like, do this one workout to look like these guys. And dude, I did that. Yeah. It was the off season, from swimming. And I did that workout probably four times a week. I was like, this is the workout. I'm going to do this one workout.
Well, there was in high school, we would go to GNC, and they used to sell this box of supplements. And it was like, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it was like, in the box was like a workout video and a program and the supplements. And, you know, obviously you had to buy the box, but it was like $300. So there's no way I'm buying it. One of the guys on my football team bought the box, took the supplements, went through everything. And he actually got pretty jacked, but it was like a ton of bodyweight calisthenic stuff. So he wasn't like a big dude, but like he ended up getting pretty yoked. And, I was always like, oh man, that's neat. Like that box idea. Now I laugh back. Like we saw that box, and that box was like, inside that box is everything we wanted getting jacked. And, you know, and then the other interesting part was like, it's not like we had access to these, I'm going to date myself, but like, you know, it's not like I was down at the library with, you know, the Dewey Decimal System, like looking at the microfiche for like this research studies. So, I mean, we didn't know. We had bodybuilding magazines, and then you had old man Zangus, you know, like, given us, good but terrible advice. So we just knew that like the biggest people lifted the heaviest weights. Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, another conversation I had many years ago. I went down to another CrossFit event down in San Diego, and we get in there, we meet the night before, we all go to dinner. And then the next morning, we're supposed to have meetings, I think starting at like 10. And so I go to breakfast with Nicholas Romanoff, you know, the inventor of the pose. And Dr. Romanoff is an amazing human being. Like such a good sense of humor, so funny and so full of just knowledge. And he told me this incredible story, which was to be a master sports scientist in Russia, you actually have to coach somebody to either a gold medal, a world championship. Like you have to take them on the journey. And then
I love that model. Oh, I wish we had that model over here.
Yeah. But I mean, you have to find somebody as like a beginner or like relatively unknown, and then take them on a multi-year journey. And then the culmination is them winning, and then you take it and you present it. So the Politburo got together and they took all their master coaches and anybody that ever coached anybody, and they asked them to submit their programs. So they submitted the programs, and they had a building and guys in lab coats, and they put all these guys in, and they gave them every program. And the idea that they were going to like put it all in, these guys were going to look at all this information, aggregate it out, and then they were going to spit out the perfect program. Yeah. So the first year goes by and nothing. Year two goes by and they still haven't done it. And then Politburo comes in with like guns and is like, you know, papers, please. And it's like, you have to present this next year. Or we're going to execute all of you, right? So then these guys get up at this like, you know, big event, like their end of their capstone event. You know, this is going to be the keynote talk, and they're going to get in and talk about all this stuff. And the guy gets up there and goes, after 3 years and thousands of programs and tens of thousands of athletes, we could only discern two things. The strongest people in the world, or the strongest individuals, lifted the heaviest weights in training. And the fastest people ran the fastest in training. That was the only thing that they could delineate from all this, is like the strongest people lifted the heaviest weights and the fastest people ran the fastest. And so he tells me this story, and I'm like, oh yeah, right? Like, and then we like finish breakfast. He tells me a bunch of other stuff, and then we go back, and I'm driving back to Orange County, and it's like, it's dark. And I remember, I'm like, wait a minute. And I'm like replaying this in my head, and I like pulled over on the side of the road, and I was like, it's not, the strongest people lift the heaviest weights and the fastest people run the fastest. Like it created such an amazing simplicity when you see that people love mm-hmm. to play, you know, create all this complexity. And mm-hmm. you know, it's going to be this, we're going to use undulating periodization, we're going to do this. Like, no, like whatever allows you to be the strongest individual, like those people lift the heaviest weights. And if you want to run fast, I mean, it goes back to my conversation with Charlie Francis in 1999. You don't get fast running by running slow. The only way you mm-hmm. get fast is by running as fast as you can. And if you run slow when you're trying to run fast, all it's going to do is make you slow. So I'd much mm-hmm. rather have you go out and run as fast as you can one time than to go out and run slow. You know, I mean, it was like, that was another impactful moment of like, if you want to run fast, you have to run fast. If you want to lift heavy weights, you actually, like, nobody backs into a 500 pound bench. Like, I didn't bench 500 pounds just benching 315 for 10. Like, I had to bench 315, 400 and start doing reps, and you make this assault, but you have to do it. And like, you know, I always love when those projections back, oh, if you can do 315 for 10 reps, you should be able to bench, you know, 400 or this. I benched 315 for 10, and I'm telling you, it did not prepare me to bench 400. The way I got good at benching 400 was benching 400. And the only way I got to 500 was by benching 400 and all the numbers in between. So it really just, and you have to have a bunch of dedicated programming for it. Like, this is what I'm specifically, I'm not trying to get good at football. I'm literally trying to chase this 500 pound bench. And it just required a lot of effort. I mean, I think I squatted 610 when I was 19. I benched 500 when I was 22.
Yeah. And that's, again, the intent and the execution is what makes that, right? It's not the, I don't know. I just feel like the current narrative around a lot of training, again, it's just so absolute, so definitive, and also is playing into people's hopes that they could fast track it. But it's like, man, you can't fast track physical adaptation. You can, to an extent, with you know, the right kind of pharmacological means, but even there, it's like you've still got to put in a necessary amount of training to get there, and just have patience. Just know that the road is long, but like, all we got is time, right? You keep going, keep showing up, keep doing the training, with the right intent, with the right execution, and it's going to end up fine. I think part of the issue too is in our circle, the power athlete circle, is we forget we are still leaps and bounds ahead of the average person. Again, now that, and I know you've talked about this before, but now that I'm going to a public gym, there's a lot of killers there, but there's also a lot of people where it's like, man, like, you, and not to their own fault, but it's like, you have no idea what you're doing. Like, I'm watching you do things and you just look like a lost puppy dog. It's been really funny because this is my wife's first time going to a commercial gym. She's been doing all the training in the garage.
Oh,
Before the first day, she was like really nervous. She's like, I don't know what to do. Like, I've never done this before. And I kind of talked her through. I was like, you know, the big one was dips. It's tough for her to do weighted dips there. So I was like, oh, this is what a dip machine looks like. You got to find one, and you're probably going to be seated. It's going to look like this, but it's still working dips. So we kind of talked through some of that stuff. And then after her first day, I was like, so how'd it go this morning? She's like, man, like, people were there. And it's just like, wow. You know, and it's just like, yeah, we forget how far along we really are just because this podcast and the training that you put out and things like that. But I think people, again, kind of get in their own little silo and they worry about things that they really don't need to worry about. And you just got to keep showing up and do the training with the intent. And all of a sudden, 5 years from now, you're going to be in a way better position than you were when you started, you know?
Well, what you're speaking against is program hopping too. You know, like that's so always an interesting one where, and it's been very rare, but I have had people reach out and like, oh, I'm not getting the results I thought I would on this program. And I'm like, well, this program is based on some very, very sound principles. Like, there's no magic, there's no wizardry. I'm not fucking over here, you know, introducing you to wizards like Matt Vincent, and he's giving you magical potions. But like, this is basic physiology, and it's a physiology that, you know, the Charles Poliquin, if you got to wait 10 years, you're going to be 10 years behind. Like, we backed into this because I had more data points than any other human being on the planet for training. And like, I saw what worked for me and I saw what worked for everybody. We, you know, I mean, really what was the strength of, you know, CrossFit Football and Power Athlete is we gave free programming away. And we ended up getting tens of thousands of people to follow the program. And I was able to get a ton of the results and see what worked and didn't work. And we had people, you know, within the gym that we were training in the front side of it. But really the principles associated with a program like Jack Street and even Grindstone and, you know, Hammer and Dragon Sight and all the other stuff are all based upon these sound principles. And so when people say, hey, I didn't get the results I was looking for, I'm like, all right, we're just talking about one variable, right? The program, right? We're not talking about execution because I've never seen you train. I don't know what your supplementation, I don't know what your nutrition, I don't know what your training background looks like. I don't know if you're doing your aerobic work. Like there are so many different variables to say this program did not work. Now, were there programs that I did that did not get me as strong? Yes, I can think of other programs, but it was interesting. The programs that didn't get me as strong had to do with too much focus on frequency. So like I got real strong training 6 days a week, right up to the point I didn't get as strong. And then the idea is like, well, if I'm not getting as strong, I need to do more. And then it really comes down to like, all right, you've trained into such an efficient, like, you know, like inter and intermuscular coordination, your nervous system, everything's so efficient. Now the same volume is actually crippling and I'm not recovering. And then it came down to like, all right, you know, like I could do 4 days a week and then the next week I could do five and then I go back to four. And I started looking at this thing like, all right, I can get these, you know, 9 workouts over 2 weeks. But when I pushed it to like 10 workouts and 12 workouts, all of a sudden it was just too much. And it wasn't until I went out to Westside and I was kind of talking to Louis Simmons about this. He said to me, he goes, the problem is that you're not doing enough GPP work. You're not doing enough, you know, like, you know, micro sessions, what he called special exercises, which was like reverse hypers and abs and med balls, all of this like base level Charlie Francis GPP stuff, which I knew. He's like, you need to do more of that. Like if you're going to raise your volume, you have to effectively raise your conditioning to match it. And he goes, you know, the problem is you're just not in shape to train. And I was like, fuck, man. Like,
that's a blow to the heart.
Well, it was. But he's like, you know, you do so much upper register stuff. Like you sprint so fast, you lift so heavy. And, you know, even to go back to the podcast we did, Joel Jameson, talking about that zone two pool being so deep and so wide that you can just fill it infinitely. And really, that's what that kind of that field work and, you know, a lot of that stuff, it's at that kind of lower heart rate, you know, 120, 130, 140 beats. And you're doing it for sustained time. And I think really just going back and looking at the conditioning, that was a massive piece for me and realizing like, could it be the fact that you're not putting on muscle because you're not in shape? Could it be the fact that, you know, you're not in shape enough to be able to train with enough relative intensity to keep driving adaptation? Because if I do the same shit this week that I did the week before and the week before and the week before, I'm sure as hell not getting stronger. I'm sure as hell not getting more muscular.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when they make that comment, it's also like, what was your expected outcome? Right? Did you think you were going to put on 15 pounds of muscle in a 3-month cycle? Because that's the thing too, and you only learn that really by doing it, right? Because again, two things: the social media that we've already talked about has done, it's created those narratives, but also, I don't think people can place other physiques in the right context, right? So like, one of the coolest things I've ever done is go to the Arnold and watch the bodybuilders there because they're in phenomenal shape, obviously. But it was also very interesting because it's like, and the same thing can be said with like CrossFit Games athletes or any professional sport, right? When we would watch things on TV, because they're surrounded by people who are about the same size as them, you have no context for what they really are. But when you go and you see like a lot of these bodybuilders in person, it's like, oh, you have these massive frames because you're only 5'7", right?
We were at the Mr. Olympia, and I'm standing backstage. We had Fairfax Heckley, who was a buddy of somehow Tex knew him from back in DC, but Fairfax was really dialed in with the Mr. Olympia and all that. So we got a chance to go out there and really just get the VIP tour. So we're standing side stage and I look over and I'm standing next to this pro bodybuilder named Nick Walker, who I think they call the Mutant. Like, I'm not kidding you. He was as wide as he was tall. And what was crazy was that, I mean, just like the size of it, like it's always funny whenever they start looking like Beetlejuice, where like the body's so big and the head shrinks. Like that dude was absolutely looked like a tank. Like he was massive. But he also came up somewhere in the middle of my torso. And it's like, dude, like these guys have packed a lot of muscle on. But if you think about, like, it's very rare to see these guys being, you know, 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". And when you do, that's impressive. You know?
Well, that's when you get, yeah, you look at, so the one sport where you don't need to be next to them to see how big they are is like the professional strongman, yeah. Right? Like the Mountain and Brian Shaw and those folks, you can just see massive. Proportionally. But that's the thing. When you have a smaller frame, you know, or a shorter frame, 5 pounds of muscle looks different than if you are 6'6", because that muscle gets distributed the same amount, right? So people having this concept of like, okay, what's a physique supposed to look like? It's like, well, you gotta, who are you basing it off of? You need to find somebody who has your similar height. That's my suggestion. Like find somebody who has your similar height and see what those look like. Because again, you know, the perspective, it just changes when you look at it just in isolation. But when you actually see those people in person, you're like, oh yeah, it's super impressive still. These bodybuilders, super impressive physiques. But then it was like, oh, you're not that big. Or like when we would watch CrossFitters on TV, it's like, man, you guys look jacked. But then you meet them in person and it's like, oh, you're 5'6" to 5'8" yeah. and 180 pounds. Like that's not as physically like wowing as it looks like on TV.
Froning's a pretty big guy,
but that's the thing. There are outliers within there.
And he's got a great beard. And he's probably one of the nicest people I've ever met. Like disgustingly nice. So,
well, that's because you run with a bunch of degenerates like us. So it's weird to see nice people.
No, I can't imagine anybody shitting on Rich Froning about anything. Like he's like not only you know, super successful as a crazy incredible athlete, but like great father, benevolent dude, takes care of all these people, and just a rad dude. And like, so like if I ever see it, I'm like, you can cast stones at me, but like not Rich Froning. That guy is like the nicest dude I've ever been around.
Yeah, I mean, the only touch point I have with that was when they hosted that final seminar and like they rolled out the red carpet from day one. I can't remember the woman that worked there. She might have been like the manager or something. I just remember when she greeted us, it felt like, you know, like your great aunt was greeting you at the door for dinner. I don't know. It was just really welcoming. But all that to say, like, I think people need to go when they critique programming or have frustrations with programming, you also have to look at like, what's your intended outcome or your desired outcome? And does that actually match with what's realistic? You know? Because again, a lot of folks hammer 90, as our case point, we've talked about it a few times. A lot of people had some great transformations, but on the back end, they were just kind of like, oh, I didn't think I would look like this. I thought I would look bigger. And it's like, well, now the nice part of doing that is now you're in a phenomenal position to start getting bigger because you've leaned out, you've dropped whatever 20 pounds of fat. So now your body's in a much better place physiologically to put on lean mass.
I know that, you know, we send in our pictures from Eat the Weakness. And as we were going through the pictures, what was pretty interesting is I was like, I think I was 20 pounds less and I look dramatically bigger, 20 pounds less than I did at the start. And, you know, Arash actually looks even like more crazy. He just looks like a spider. His arms are so long, but, you know, like your stuff too, man. I mean, like you just got so much more compact and it was neat to see. The only one that we didn't get was Pollock's pictures. I'm a little bummed he hasn't set him. So we might have to shame him a little bit to get those.
That's because it's probably surrounded by pierogies and sauerkraut and all of his foods. But yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing. It looks, cause I was the same way. I was down, I don't know, 20, 22 pounds, something like that. But without that context, without like, cause you're taking these pictures against this blank wall. It's like, I have no markers of how big you are. It's like, well, you look bigger. And the one telling one is when you go like side profile and it's like, oh no, you've slimmed down quite a bit. But yeah, I think it'll just be, it'll be interesting. The second round, like I said, Hammer 90, we're about a month out and, there's some huge changes. One thing that the coaches, Brian, Johnny, and Dave and I have been talking about is, and you touched on it kind of like CrossFit blew up. I'm really excited because we had a few women in the first go round, but we got quite a few more women in this go round. And purely from a business standpoint, yeah, the women sell, right? The transformation pictures for women sell. Dudes, they're impressive, whatever. But like what really sells for whatever reason is, if we can show that the women who do this also see great transformations. And some of these, like Tori, one of our Block One coaches, she's going to go down 2 weight classes for jits by the end of this. And that's like, that's wild, but she's looking awesome. A lot of the women, Rita, Polly over in the UK, we got a lot of women who are crushing it, making big changes. And so I'm excited to get those pictures out because, you know, at the end of the day, and this is something else that I'm really excited about for the hypertrophy seminar, it's like a 4-letter word to talk about wanting to look good, right? And people are like, oh, that's too vain. It's like, man, like at the end of the day, like that's, to me, that's all that matters. Performance, if you're in a sport, sure, that matters. But if you're not playing a sport, you want to be able to look good and feel good about how you look, right? And, you know, I think, is it vain? Sure. But if that vanity is the vehicle that keeps you, you know, making healthy choices, training consistently, whatever, like more about, I'm all for it, man. Like be as vain as you want to be, because at the end of the day, now that people are hungry on Hammer 90, they're talking about like, oh, I'm just super hungry. And it's like, man, nothing tastes as good as being shredded. Like that's like, it just doesn't, you know? And so once you get there, and that's the other thing too, is like, you only got to get there once, right? Like you only got to get in really good shape once. And then it's pretty easy. You can, you know, you let it go a little bit. You and I talked about before this last Hammer 90, it's like, put on a couple pounds more, but you just got to do it once. And then you can get back there a lot easier. But, you know, the hypertrophy side of things, again, if you're playing a sport, performance-based hypertrophy, there's a place and time in the season. But if you're not playing a sport, I firmly believe, like out of all of our programs, most people should just get on Jack Street. Yeah. Because like at the end of the day, put on lean muscle, lift heavy weights, get all the benefits from that, and you end up looking pretty dang good.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. So just to kind of wrap it all up, here at Power Athlete, we're hosting a hypertrophy seminar. We're going to call it the Hypertrophy Standard. It's going to be 2 days. Ben, myself, and some of the guys are going to be there. You know, we'll post a link on the ticket in the show notes, and I'll actually physically give it to you right now. You can go to powerathletehq.com/the Hypertrophy Standard. We'll post the link in the show notes. And then, so not only are you guys going to be here, but we're going to have 2 days, not only of lecture, but a practical. We're going to get into supplements and we're going to get into the weeds. We're going to get a bunch of training sessions. We're going to break it into an upper lower. So it's going to be like a chest and a shoulders, a tricep, a back, and then we're going to hit all the lower body stuff. And so we're going to work through a lot of different movements and see what drives and what, more importantly, how we can basically service people to be the most effective people they can be in the gym.
Well, and with the people that are going to be there, right, there's you, me, Waldman's going to be down. So people get a chance to interact with Waldman. If you've been on the Discord and you got any bumps and bruises, Double D, Dennis is going to be down. So there's the programming stuff that we're going to do. But then, you know, a lot of our coaches, Johnny Durrett, Shumway, MCK is going to be down. Bill's going to be in town. So you're going to get one-on-one, or maybe not one-on-one, but you're going to get real close point of contact with our coaches. And there's all sorts of benefits from that as well. So I think it's going to, I mean, obviously I think it's valuable, but, yeah, I think it's going to be a great time. And then, you know, it's always good to get in on the ground floor. Yeah. It's always good to be the first one to see what's up, because the first one's always a little bit unique. So awesome. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. So if you guys want to come train with us, click on the link. You got it. And we'll see you here in May. And other than that, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. See you.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by kofi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's kofi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.